Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Hello, welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. This is the second part of my interview with Emilio Viano. I actually wasn't expecting this to be a two-part interview, but the conversation was really fascinating. And when you start talking about crime, criminology around the world, international, it all relates back to politics and how we deal with different countries. So we started diving into international politics, which you all know is something that I'm very interested in. And it's such an important part of how crimes start, occur, why crimes occur. You know, not just all people are bad. We create environments that encourage crime at times. And so what are we doing and why is that happening? And when it's just nefarious people acting out, how do we take care of that as well? So it's very interesting conversation that we have. So let's get into part two of the interview with Emilio Viano. You recently met with Pope Francis at the Vatican. What did you two discuss, and what crimes does he see as the most critical to put an end to?
Well, first of all, let me point out that I was really surprised that the Pope was so much informed and up to date in this area. In other words, it wasn't just a courtesy visit that you can expect if you met the president of the country or an important politician or an important figure where, hi, how are you? What do you do? I'm so impressed by your work. I bless you and wish you, you know, great success. It's an important issue and I'm very concerned about it.
They give you a pat on the back and say, keep doing your good work.
Yeah, and go. It was a real serious conversation. I have to say, I was really impressed by that. I was really flabbergasted in a way that he really knew the issue. In his mind, some of the most important issues are, for example, the use of the death penalty in many countries, because he sees it as a way to control freedom of expression, political freedom, dissent, and also to impose the control of certain groups in a society over the others.
So, because in the United States, we use it for people who supposedly have committed a really heinous crime.
Yeah.
But in a lot of other countries, they use it as just political prisoners or whatever.
Yeah. And as you know, even in the U.S., there are plenty of cases of wrong convictions and the execution of the innocent. And today that we indeed have some DNA evidence, at times after someone has been killed and they finally analyze the DNA, they say, whoops, it wasn't him, mm-hmm. it was someone else. So even we at times have wrong convictions, and typically this conviction also impact minorities, lower socioeconomic level, whites and blacks and whatever, than more the upper classes.
Are there other countries that use it significantly to keep certain groups in line?
Well, yeah, we are among those countries, unfortunately. As you know, China is certainly probably the country that uses the death penalty most often for this reason, that they actually execute thousands of people every year. Until recently, the family even had to pay for the bullets with which the person would be executed. Apparently now they don't ask for that payment anymore. Some people consider it an advance, maybe. So China is certainly one of those countries. The same is with some of the countries we are very allied to, like Saudi Arabia, and that executes a lot of people, also through decapitation mostly. And we, unfortunately, with Russia, are also very much up there among the top countries in the world that use the death penalty. In the U.S., to be fair, as you know, not all states have it. Some of them, like Michigan, have abolished it since the mid-1800s. But others, like Texas, Florida, Virginia, and some others, use it rather liberally. And so he was very concerned about that. The other is another side of the coin that he was very concerned about, what he considered the increase in sentences to life without possibility of parole. that he says is basically the death penalty, but with the added torture of having to wait for decades to finally, you know, be free, so to speak. And he also felt that this was an excessive, harsh justice imposed on people, because he said anyone should be deemed able to reform. Anyone should be given a chance to say, I change. And by sending people to prison without possibility of parole means we are giving up on you. You will never change. You don't have a chance. It is worthless for you to even try. You might as well, you know, jump off a cliff, so to speak, if you could. So in a way, it felt that this is also very wrong, that it is not justice. Because while he said forgiveness is one thing, but justice is also important, justice has also to have this component of giving a hope of rehabilitation, of reform, of rejoining society in a fruitful and positive way. And the other areas where he was very concerned, and we talked a lot about it, is of course the area of trafficking, because he thinks that it connects very much with a theme that he is very much outspoken about, namely the accumulation of wealth at the top of the 1%, as we call it, in our country, and the fact that the rest is living in increasingly substandard levels. Yes, we all have jobs. Yes, we all have some food. But in the end, the disparity in wealth is so stark that it is just unimaginable. And that he sees, you know, the trafficking as an expression of that, that it is very easy for people to buy other humans, to buy their parts, to buy their services, to use them and throw them away as disposable items. And he felt that that is one of the illnesses of our society, in the sense of this basic lack of empathy and of respect for one another, regardless of how rich you are, regardless if you have a Louis Vuitton or a Dolce & Gabbana dress on you, or you have only some rags or blue jeans. It's not important. He felt very strongly about that, which is, of course, the basis also of democracy. In the end, that is why we take so great pride in our country, where per se there is equality, theoretically, of all of us in front of the law.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the World Bank, because you also sit on the forum, the Global Forum on Law, Justice, and Development for the World Bank. What does that entail?
Well, the forum is an initiative of the World Bank in response to some criticism that it wasn't engaged enough in many of the issues that we have discussed in the last few minutes, particularly the word itself, the development. What does development mean? Obviously, development means something very different from the investor billionaire who is developing a coal mine to, let's say, the people in the area that are going to go down below grade and mine the coal, or those whose property may be taken, or water may be polluted, or air may be become unbreathable. So what is development? And that is really the question that has been posed to the World Bank. And so then the word justice. So it is justice, law, and development. And it tries to, once a year, but it's not just once a year. There is work all during the year that it culminates in, and normally it's at the beginning of November, as it will be this year, starting November 6th, to bring together literally 1,500 to 2,000 persons from all over the world, many of them from the developing world, discussing this issue. For example, we have spent the whole year preparing for development and gender issue. In other words, what does development do for women? How does development benefit or victimize women? How do we make sure that if there is development, women have a chance and a seat at the table? So these are very important issues that often are neglected, even in our own society. If you think about it, there aren't that many women in boardrooms. There aren't that many women president of major corporations. And there aren't that many women billionaires, unless some of them inherited. So there is still the famous glass ceiling that is playing a role in all of this. So the Global Forum is indeed an attempt to keep the World Bank responsible, accountable, sensitized, and aware that we are watching what they are doing. Because their temptation, of course, as a major development bank, and it is understandable that works with governments in particular, to go for the big projects and to look only, let's say, at the technical side and at the financial side. But this says, wait a minute, there are other sides. There are the people who are being affected. What is it doing for them? I give you an example. In Ethiopia, along the Nile River there, where Australopithecus Africanus walked maybe 50, 100,000 years ago. Now they want to build and are building actually a huge, immense dam that will dam the Nile. And of course, it's done in part for potable water, but most of all for agriculture. What does this do though? It displaces tribes like the Oromo that have been there for thousands of years, that still live there the same way that their ancestors lived, depend on the flow and ebb of the river, the river, cresting and affecting, and invading their territory and then retreating and leaving behind precious earth deposits that are very fertile. Well, these people now, what is happening to them? They've all been rounded up and brought to camps, the typical camps, where you get the little, house without any services, and they've been allowed to bring one cow. Many of them depended on cows for meat and blood and milk. As you know, in some cultures, they also drink the blood of the cows as a source of protein because they don't want to kill them. They are too valuable for them. So they get the blood and the milk. Well, they had to let go of their herds. They were taken from them. They were rounded up by the army. They were taken to these camps, one cow per family, and they lost everything. And of course, now they are in a world neither of their ancestors a thousand years ago or modern, because no one is helping them make the transition. So they're totally lost. This is where this forum comes in saying, what are we doing here? This might have been done in colonial times, when people didn't have sensitivity enough or knowledge enough. They didn't know. They thought of themselves so superior that they didn't have to take into account the indigenous aboriginal population. But today, we have moved along quite a bit. So what are we doing to these people? What are we helping them in the transition at least? Or respecting at least certain areas that should remain untouched for them? This is an example.
A great example, because many people think the World Bank is a major contributor to crime, and, or at the very least, shields known criminals. I think that's a perfect example of what that question is pointing to. And it's because of the governments and the local people want it. The World Bank gets focused on development from a money standpoint instead of looking at how it affects the people. And everything becomes so money-oriented and so kind of inhumane. Who put this forum together? Because it seems like the forum is the solution in so many ways to so many problems we have, as long as they'll listen to you. So, I mean, that's part of the issue, too.
Sure. But first of all, allow me to say that I will not go as far as say that the World Bank is supporting criminals or making it possible.
But indirectly, they do. They might not be aware of it.
Oh, okay. But just to make a point, that I don't think that I have any evidence of that per se, or that I want to go that far, and I don't think it is necessary.
And I understand. That doesn't help anybody to point fingers and stuff. But what you're doing actually, is, I don't know. Go ahead, talk about the forum. Who put it together?
Yeah, What I'm saying, that without saying that, which seems to me somewhat reckless and also needing more evidence, even though there may be, I don't know. I think that, yes, it is true that at times the action of the international institutions, not just the World Bank, may indeed favor certain decisions that are not in the best interest of people or even just and respectful of human rights. We only have to think of what is happening in certain Latin American countries, for example, where there is exploitation of oil and indigenous populations that at times have had no contact with modern men, as we like to call ourselves, are forced into these contacts. And not only they still fall prey to diseases that we only are resistant to, but see their habitat totally destroyed and their way of life totally annihilated to the Amazonian forest that is being cut down with a tremendous impact on not only on Brazilians or the aboriginal populations there, but on all of us, because it's still the only really major forest that can be considered the lungs of the earth. And it is disappearing at a faster rate because there is more wealth, there is more investment, there is more international aid, and therefore more roads, and more roads that are not just white roads, namely dirt roads, but paved roads, which allow heavy trucks to go and bring machinery for more destruction, for more construction, so on and so forth. The construction, for example, of the dam called Belo Monte that has created a lake that is as big as half Virginia with immense impact on the climate and on the way of life of fauna, flora, aboriginal population. I mean, you have these events that are of dramatic proportion, and often they pass not perceived because they are in remote areas of the world where there isn't much of coverage by the media, but that they impact real people and destroy real lives. And in the case of Latin America in particular, destroy forests that are important to us too.
But that's why making sure the local people and, you know, like if all the decisions are made at a global level, we're going to be unaware of what's going on at the local level. And if you don't take into account the people that are there, then you're going to make mistakes because you just don't know. But, you know, I had an activist who also worked at the World Bank tell me that the World Bank can do a lot of negative things, but it's only if the governments and the local people don't care, or if it depends on what the local people are doing. If the local government is very conscious of taking care of their people, then everything that happens is good usually. It usually goes back to what the governments are like and what the people are like locally. Or if there's another group like the United States or another nefarious act, like another state or private group with a lot of money is putting a lot of pressure on the local people in nefarious ways, then the World Bank may not know about it. But I don't like to say the World Bank is all innocent either.
No. But remember, these international organizations, the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, the Organization of American States, the United Nations, are not self-standing institutions. They are run by their members. Mm-hmm. And so their members are, of course, they are as good as their members are.
Exactly. Particularly
the more influential ones. So at times we say, why doesn't the United Nations do this or that? Because its members, particularly the Security Council members, don't want to. And they are, particularly if they have veto power, is enough that one.
Well, it's like the Saudi Arabia. Yeah, the Saudi Arabia being the head of women's rights.
Of course. And then we had the Libya chairing the Human Rights Committee.
It's just silly.
Of course. But you cannot not do it because that's the system. You cannot say, wait a minute, show me your credentials. It's just a rotating thing where they are elected. And you have blocks of votes that are going to these countries for nationalistic or regional interests. For example, in the case of Libya or Saudi, it might be African countries that that are very angry and are chafing at the pressure by the Western Northern countries putting pressure on them for human rights. And they say, we are going to show you, you know, our reaction, and we make Libya, as they did years ago, the chair of the committee to show you. The same as, let's face it, in our own country, depending on your political point of view, the recent election also has given a voice to some people that wanted a certain type of government to come into play. It's similar. And therefore, it is hard to say the UN is bad, the UN is good. They are just as bad or good as their members are, particularly in the case of the UN, of course, the Security Council, and they are those who have the veto power. And the World Bank is the same. It depends on the share, because the World Bank is like a corporation, and some countries have more share and therefore more votes than others. And the ones that have more share, the UN, the US being obviously one of them, certainly look after their own interests.
Yeah, see, I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that, because I could see that's just how it works everywhere. I think, though, if you end up having a larger percentage of nefarious people that kind of take over something, then you kind of have a mess on your hands. So it's so important that our institutions and our frameworks work in a way to just keep weeding those people out. And unfortunately, when you start seeing trends of bad behavior, I think the percentage of criminals are too high in positions of power.
You know, what is in line with this and what you're saying, what is concerning me, and I'm sure many other people, is in a way the isolationism that appears to be in fashion now in our country at the federal level government. For example, the withdrawal of the U.S. from this free trade agreement with South Asian countries, excluding China, in order to give us a role in the region. Because what is that doing? It's opening the door for China, and they did it right away. They immediately invited all those countries to Beijing for a conference to say, come with us. And as you know, they even started their own World Bank in Shanghai. So our isolationism is now allowing China to develop and blossom beautifully. The isolationism of the current government is the best gift for them, because now they are the champion of the climate change. Now they are the champion of globalization and free trade. Now they are the champions of helping South Asian countries develop. Now, not all of this is true, but it appears that way. And they are certainly not a democratic country. So we are, in a way, ceding territory to them, influencing the world, while they are not necessarily espousing our values of democracy and human rights. And I can see serious consequences coming out of that, financially, prestige, and business-wise impacting us negatively,
well,
but also the human rights and the rule of law.
Well, I think it's a two-edged sword, because the trade agreements, you know, were they the best for the United States? But yet, if you don't do it, then you're going to, you know, lift up China. But we also have a problem with Russia. Doing all these sanctions against Russia, all that's doing is helping China, because Russia's putting a lot more, they were going to rely a lot more on the East and pull away from us even more. So I'm not, I don't know. I think a lot of the things we're doing is not in our best interest in a lot of ways. I don't know about the trade agreement. I think a lot of the, I'm on the fence there, because I think a lot of the trade agreement wasn't in our best interest either, but totally pulling out isn't good either.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. No, it's like when George W. Bush, George Bush's son, canceled, you know, the signature on, let's say, the conventions on the right of the child, or on other human rights treaties that Clinton had signed. Those are gestures that send a powerful message that we are not supporting certain important measures to protect vulnerable population. And I'm with you that this free trade agreement with South Asia had critics also because it was negotiated very much in secret, and we really didn't know very much what was in it. I completely agree with you. But it gave us a role. It gave us a seat at the table and at the chairmanship of the table. And the same with the climate agreement. We were at least in play. And let me correct my statement. George Bush canceled the signature of Clinton on the International Criminal Court. And that, too, took us off a very important legal international development and the ability to influence where it goes and how it is developed. So certainly, you know, there are at times decisions that, in my opinion, are against our best interests, but serve domestic interests to keep the base happy, to be reelected, whatever it might be. But it is short-sighted because we cannot stop globalization. We cannot go back to the coal era of the 19th century when coal was the king. Of course, they had to stop that because London was becoming totally black and people couldn't breathe anymore. And just imagine, let me give you an example. How many workers does China have in the alternative energy field today? Well, it is estimated that 2.5 million people. How many do we have? 260,000 plus.
All of their new developments is off the grid. We have old infrastructure. All their new stuff is all self-sustaining. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, and how many will they have by 2020? 10 million. So I'm saying, as you can see, there are decisions being made. For example, in this case, what type of energy we want to favor in our country. But it is, for example, in this case, in my opinion, of course, a source of energy of the 19th century. Are we going to reintroduce steam locomotives because we can use coal and they create more employment because you need, of course, the conductor and you need those that put the coal into the stove that is generating the steam that is moving the train? I mean, you could justify reintroducing steam locomotives to generate more employment. That is ridiculous. China is going to eat us for lunch.
I agree that they are going to eat us for lunch. And I think the difference between globalization, meaning it's becoming a globalized world where we're all trading with each other, versus a globalized power that's going to tell us what to do. There's
exactly
a difference.
I think that is a great statement you made. And this is what is worrying some of us, that you cannot stop globalization. And we see it because in the end, as you know, some people accuse the current government of being hypocritical in line because what they sell on their own private business is made abroad too. And while they criticize firms that go abroad to produce their goods, you cannot get out of it anymore. You cannot say,
it is what it is.
Yeah, buy American, hire American, and then your stuff is made in Bangladesh. And rightly so, because
he has to make it in Bangladesh. Yeah.
But then let's not play games with it. Let's say there is globalization. It is a challenge. It is forcing us to be attentive and invest wisely. And most of all, let's move with new sources of energy. Let's be at the forefront of that. Let's be the champions. Let me give you another example that worries me a lot. I travel a lot, and I use very often, and I'm sure you do too, high-speed trains in Europe, high-speed trains in China, high-speed trains in Japan. We don't have one in this country. There is a make-believe high-speed train between Washington, New York, and Boston, where you pay double to, say, 20 minutes. That is not a high-speed train. So we don't have a single one. While Europe is full of them, China is fantastic, and Japan, as you know,
isn't it true that they don't have to spend all that money on military, but we are? We have military bases everywhere. A lot of countries rely on our military to deal with stuff, and so especially Japan, they get to spend their money on building out their infrastructure while we're spending our money on the world's military.
But Sarah, that is our decision.
I know, but I'm not saying it's a good one.
let me quote the president. just last night in West Virginia. What did he say? We wasted $6 trillion on the Middle East. So this is the president of the United States who says we wasted $6 trillion in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, whatever. Is he stopping the war? No. Is he saying from now on the $6 trillion go to high-speed train, renovating our highways? We have bridges here in Washington.
Building energy.
Rusting. It's not. So it's a decision that we make that we want to be the big military power. Do you know how I see this country going somehow? Somehow it's becoming like the mercenaries of the Middle Ages and at the Renaissance time. As you know, I don't know if you do, but at the time in Europe, the countries became relatively weak because they were very divided and very small. So if you had a beef disagreement with your neighbor, you didn't have enough of an army to fight. What would you do? You would hire one. And there were military mercenary armies that you could rent and go to for you. And we are becoming a little bit like that. We are becoming a country that is very strong on the military, but is going to end up being very weak in almost everything else. And China, for now, cycles change. In 50 years, maybe Brazil is taking over in that area. And we are letting them. We are opening the door for them by saying international commerce, globalization, no. We don't want any of them. Buy American, hire American, supposedly. Well, that is the autarky is a name, is a word from the Greek that means you produce all that you need and you only consume what you produce. It was the slogan of some European countries in the 1930s. Well, in a way, it is being resuscitated today here, but we cannot do that anymore. The 1930s, you could, because there was very little communication. Trains were slow, boats were slow, people didn't trade so much as we do today. Today you cannot do that. You cannot say, I produce all that I need and I consume only what I produce. Even farmers go to Safeway or Giant or Whole Foods or the supermarkets. They don't produce everything that they eat at dinner table. Some of them, they don't produce any of it. They might produce only corn, period, or soy or wheat. So today, this has changed enormously. And that is what worries me, because I love this country, and I think we have a tremendous role to play in the world to defend human rights, freedom, and democracy, and we are very good at that. But we are going about it the wrong way, and emphasizing mostly the military. Look at what China is doing.
Yeah, the emphasis on the military is going to kill us. But
China doesn't have many bases, military bases abroad, almost none. But what do? They come in and say, we are going to build your roads. Do you need a football stadium? Don't worry. We are building it for you. They did it all over Central and South America. We send our workers, we send our stuff, which means we sell our stuff. So we are making money in the end because we are selling our stuff to ourselves. But that is what foreign aid is all about. So we build your stadium. We build your roads. We help you build the next Panama Canal in Nicaragua. In other words, they do soft power stuff, mostly financially. They say to Argentina, we are going to rebuild your rail system. We are going to help you modernize your Buenos Aires harbor.
So for that foreign aid that they're essentially giving back to themselves through developing projects for them, what do they get in exchange in South America, China?
Well, first of all, China gets rid of its own, of what it produces, and sends its own workforce, so it has full employment. If I produce a lot of construction material and I have more than I need in my own country, it's smart for me to build in your country and get rid of it.
But if you're paying for it, you might get rid of it. But if China's actually paying for it, what are they getting in exchange?
What I'm saying, first of all, you are getting in exchange internally the fact that you have full employment, that you can keep producing this stuff and people get their salary, even though it goes abroad, and goes abroad mostly gratis, theoretically. Then when you build it there, you send your people. What China builds abroad is built by Chinese, not by other people. So there too, you are helping your own full employment, and these people send money back home to buy groceries. But then what do you get? One, you get the appreciation. Two, you get soft power. Three, you get influence. Four, you get them trade. You say, hey, you know, we need soy. Or, hey, we have all these goods very cheap. Let's bring them in for your people. They don't have very much, and we give them to you very cheap.
It turns into trade. It turns into trade. It turns into soft power. It turns exactly. into more influence in the area.
And the image also. And the image also. So they do it very subtly, but they are conquering the markets so that everywhere you go now, everything is made in China, very little made in USA. And that's where we are losing, because we are not following this philosophy. On the contrary, they are talking about substantially cutting the State Department, foreign aid, and all of that, which is a misguided measure, because, as you know, foreign aid is a misnomer. Foreign aid is our aid. If we say to a country, we are going to help your agriculture with tractors, guess where those tractors are made? In the U.S. So we are giving our tractors to them, which means we keep our factories humming, their employees paid mensually, monthly, that they can put food on the table, and we continue advancing and developing tractors. So that is how it is done. It's not that we give them $2 billion and say, spend it and be good with it. We said, we give you $2 billion to stay here in this country. We send you tractors that we make.
And I think that makes sense. I think you can do it strategically. But if you're doing it like where we set up some stuff to do foreign aid in Haiti, for example, and then we don't get anything done and we use it as a way to milk the local area, now it turns into something that might have been strategic and good to something where we might be, or we are, kind of criminal. Does that make sense?
Well, of course, there may be cases where when that happens, and that is also the concern about China. That China may come in as a benign country, helping, smiling, and assisting you, and then eventually change into an exploiter, into yeah. something that is then, you know,
it's going always the case.
Your interest. But at least initially, they do it in a proper way. And then it is up to the local people, of course, particularly if we had a good functioning international system of supervision, to keep it that way. But that certainly is always a danger, is always a challenge, is always a risk, no doubt about it. But we have done the same ourselves, of course.
Yeah, it's a risk for whoever. And that's part of setting up the frameworks and things to make sure that we don't get taken advantage of. In the end, we don't really take advantage of others in an evil way. You know, I mean, it's just not right.
That is the theoretical, hopeful, ideal world. It doesn't always work that way, but at least we tried. And it is, in my opinion, sad that we're giving up on that, that we are saying no. You know, look, for example, of where are we in South America, Central America now? Nowhere. We are basically only in Mexico saying we are going to build a wall to keep you out, to keep you away. But where is our presence in a positive way? Nowhere.
But China is all over the place. China is in Argentina, in Brazil, in Ecuador, in Peru. They're building harbors. They are telling Nicaragua.
We're all over the place militarily.
But not there. They threw us out. As a matter of fact, we had a base, for example, in Ecuador, and they told us, get out of here. So we don't have much military presence in South America. No, not at all. And in other parts of the world, it's mostly the Middle East and the traditional one, like Korea, Japan.
Military is not the same thing. I mean, that's a little different than what China's doing.
No, I agree with you.
Yeah, I know you do.
What I'm saying that we are not there in a positive way that impacts the life of people, that you can say then afterwards, we have made your life better. And for example, it might seem silly to you, but they built, let's say, the football stadium for San Jose, Costa Rica. People love it. They say the Chinese built it. For generations, they will be grateful to them because soccer is so important to them, like to for us too. Football is very important. And the fact that someone built them a nice, beautiful, immense stadium is a source of great pride and gratitude. What does it cost? Not that much. They built it with their own material, with their own workers. So you see there where you get the positive image, the positive perception that then allows you to influence what's going on, even politically, because then people listen to your statement. Like now we are condemning Maduro in Venezuela, rightly so. But where is this condemnation going? Nowhere, because we have not been friends of Venezuela for quite a while. We have done very little for them. So then what influence do we have? Zilch, very little. So as you can see, we have to cultivate. And unfortunately, in the past, even under the Obama administration, there has been quite a bit of neglect of South America. And these are our closest neighbors. For us to continue being a powerful country, the idea is not to build walls and close the borders. It is to say, let's make the whole Americas, North, Central, and South, one union. Because as a block like that, we will then be great actors on the international scene. And we will be the leaders. Like in Europe, in the European Union, there is no one who denies that Germany is the leader and followed by France. It's known. But Angela Merkel says something, everyone pays attention. And it would happen to us too. Instead, they'll say, no, you know, go away. We don't want to talk to you. And we are going to build a wall and keep you out. Stay away. That is not how we are going to ensure our future, particularly for our children and grandchildren. The future is in opening up, building alliances, building, for example, a united Americas, and then say to the world, now, take us on if you can. Not militarily, economically. If you want to go anywhere, we are where there is the critical mass of everything, from minerals to oil to forest to wheat to soy, to industrial products, to the best innovations in software and electronics. I mean, we are at the top of the world as a country in those areas. But now we are retreating. And that is, of course, for me, a very serious strategic mistake.
It's a very serious mistake. But it also has to do with our education, which is a whole other subject. But let's finish this out here. What are you currently working on as your main objectives? And where can people learn more about you and your work?
Well, we are working on a number of initiatives because, of course, it is an international network of professionals, and there are some regional projects and some international projects. Actually, surprisingly, because of what you stressed in the interview itself, we are very much becoming involved, one, in prison reform. We are very concerned as a professional association in the area of crime, that our country is becoming one, or is, no, is becoming, is one of the countries with the largest prison population in the world.
It is. And we're like multiple of all these other countries.
Yes. And we keep company with unsavory characters like China, Saudi, Russia, etc. So I wouldn't really mention them as a badge of honor. So
their statistics aren't out there. Ours are, at least. When you look at statistics, sure, we look worse than them, but theirs just isn't published.
Of course. I completely agree with you. There is where we want to really make an impact on prison reform, pointing out that imprisoning people is not the solution. And unfortunately, as you know, it seems that with the current attorney general and government, they are going the other direction. They want indeed to be even more strict and severe and punishing, which is, of course, a big, big mistake. But don't forget, unfortunately, there too, there are powerful interests. The correctional field is a huge source of income for all sorts of people, from the places where they put the prisons, which are often in economically depressed areas, to create more employment, to all those who furnish everything, from bread to sheet to soap to whatever. So it's big business. And this is really also a problem that we have to fight against.
that the economic variable, the economic play is distorting our view of the function of the correctional system. It has become this big, big source of income, and it is disturbing indeed that the current Attorney General has countermanded an Obama decision and reopened the use of private prisons that were closed to federal prisoners by Obama because of terrible abuse, terrible mismanagement, poor and scarce food, no medical care, and whatever else you can list. So in that respect, we want to be active on that because we think it's just too important. I mean, we have, particularly among minorities, the numbers, the percentages are staggering.
Yeah, it's off the charts.
Yes, and this has also an impact eventually on the burden on society. Again,
it's already having an impact, and it's not affecting children and the child welfare systems, because the amount of children that end up going into those systems are higher because of our mass incarceration.
Yeah, and because when the father and or the mother are incarcerated, it falls on the grandparents, if there are any, to raise the grandchildren, and or, you know, the welfare system with all the consequences that we know. So the price is even higher. Plus, it really destroys communities. Imagine, and this is something that many people don't think about. It. We know that there are neighborhoods where there are, let's say, minority groups where, unfortunately, and it becomes very unjustly, the incarceration rate is very high. What does that mean? It means that the neighborhood is basically very poor because there isn't the breadwinner, being male or female, there isn't disposable income. So people don't go to the store with a lot of money to spend. This is going to impact whom? The store owner, who of course is not making enough money and eventually closes down. Exactly, because many of these neighborhoods, as you know, lack many basic services, banks, supermarkets, stores, all sorts of services. They don't go there because they cannot make money. So what happened? That we have a pauperization of entire areas of our cities, where lack of services are the expression of the poverty generated there.
Wouldn't you say it's an unhealthy environment, it's an unhealthy situation, and then that just filters everywhere?
Of course. Very well said. Very well said. So that's an area we are working on. The other area where we are working on, because we are trying to become more involved in, indeed, South Asia, African countries. We have good membership in Africa, and our members are asking for this, is indeed the whole issue of trafficking of human beings, and also genital mutilation, forced marriages of young women, and so on and so forth. And these are all big issues, as you know, that go on even in our own country. There are even in our own country young women that during school vacations are sent back home to be genitally mutilated. There are cases of 10, 11-year-olds sent home to be married to people they never even met, and so on and so forth. So we want to work very much in that area. But the best project that we really are working now to develop, and hopefully we'll get some funding, is still always in crime prevention. We think that is really where we have to put most of our effort. How can we prevent crime? So what we want to do, and we are looking for funds, but we have already done a lot of work, is to look at all the research. What are the best approaches? What are the best mechanisms, techniques? How do we go about it, taking into account, of course, differences in neighborhoods, in cities, urban areas, rural areas, and so on and so forth. And that is really what we want to do in the next 5 years of our association, to do an international comparative effort to come up with the best models and start creating, and we already have talked to some donors, and it seems that it might be a viable idea, a prize for different cities in the world that are making remarkable strides in crime prevention. But crime prevention that is not just more police and more guns and more people in prison. It's real change and real improvement of the life of the people living there.
So how can people get hold of you?
Well, we do have a website, which is intercrim.com. So very simple. You know, we can easily type it in, inter, like international, intercrim, one word, .com. And there are ways there to send us a message, which is the easiest way to do it.
Okay, well, great. I'll have it up on the video and on the show page for the radio listeners. So thank you so much for joining us today. I think it was really enlightening and seeing different perspectives.
I really appreciate the invitation. And you were a wonderful interviewer. Your questions were excellent, very pointed, and very well thought out. It was a joy to work with you.
Well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
That's all we got for today. I want to thank you for listening to Business Game Changers. And I want to remind you that if you haven't gone to my website yet, sarahwestall.com, all of my episodes are there. You can see everything that I've done. And the first part of this show, if you haven't heard that as well. And if you're liking the stuff that I put out, please consider to support the show on Patreon. It's Patreon under Sarah Westall. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing weekend.